Opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Fentanyl poisoning is a growing problem in our community, but we can help do something about it. Join us September 18th at 1 p.m. at the Riverfront Park Amphitheater for the Decennium Giving Circle to celebrate a beautiful heart taken from our community entirely too soon. The concert is free, but there will be a raffle with prizes donated by local businesses and artists. So come on down, because we can all make a difference.
Look, staying healthy isn't easy. Watching your diet, hitting the gym, avoiding stress. But a good night's rest helps boost your overall health and wellness. And it couldn't be easier. The new Sleep Number 360 smart bed senses and automatically adjusts to keep you both effortlessly comfortable. The result? You wake up ready for anything. Proven quality sleep is life-changing sleep. Don't miss our Labor Day weekend special where all smart beds are on sale. Save 50% on the new Sleep Number 360 limited edition smart bed. Plus free premium delivery when you add a base. Ends Labor Day.
Californians can make history this summer. First by recalling Gavin Newsom. And on the same ballot, electing a conservative leader with a proven record, Ted Gaines.
Hi, this is Ted Gaines. As a state lawmaker, I fought the tax and spend liberals at the Capitol. As an independent business owner, I fight big insurance companies on behalf of small businesses. On California's tax board, I fight to uphold Prop 13 and protect homeowners and taxpayers. I'm running for governor because we can rescue our state from Newsom's failed agenda. As your governor, I'll slash the gas tax and keep cost of living in check. I'll stop liberal plans to defund the police, and I will veto any bill that raises taxes, period. You deserve a governor who can transform California into a safe and affordable place to raise a family. I'm Ted Gaines. That's my pledge to you. Please vote yes on the recall and vote Ted Gaines for governor.
Visit TedGaines.com. Paid for by Gaines for Governor 2021.
Take a stroll down Memory Lane at Memory Lane Antiques and Vintage. Whether you're looking for tools from the past, vintage clothing, collectibles, jewelry, or something that just reminds you of the good old days, you can find it at Memory Lane. Those special shabby chic and vintage style items are seen in every nook and cranny. So what are you waiting for? Sure, you can check out their Facebook page, but it's a lot more fun to explore the past and find your treasure. 1665 Pine Street in Redding. Memory Lane Antiques and Vintage. Vintage.
This is RC from Tobacco and Brew with this month's Cigar of the Humidor. Today we're sharing Perez Carrillo Trilogy. This gift set is the pinnacle of years tirelessly dedicated to the perfection of cigars. Rating 95, 96, and 98 by Cigar Aficionado, these three cigars have put Ernesto Perez Carrillo at the top of the industry. Come down to the best cigar shop around, Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
From the Pacific Justice Institute, this is The Legal Edge.
The Biden administration has stated that it would be sending, quote, strike force teams to private residences in order to question households on their vaccination status, as well as offer vaccinations. To be informed about your rights, visit pji.org.
We rely on your generous support to continue to provide justice for all. Learn more at pji.org.
30 years ago, Simpson University arrived in Redding with a promise to serve the North State. Warmly welcomed by this far Northern California community, we forged lasting partnerships, serving our neighbors locally as well as globally. Building on our promise, Simpson University now offers over 20 degree programs. Our promise to be the gateway to world service begins in our backyard. Learn more about Reading's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
High Noble Safe Company, formerly known as Cold Steel Safe Company at 2559 Larkspur Lane, is having a summer clearance sale. Save big on some of the highest quality safes around. High Noble Safe Company carries High Noble, Browning, and American Security, just to name a few, and features gun safes, home safes, and high security safes with stores in Redding, Roseville, and Petaluma. Delivery, moving, and repair service available. Call 530-223-5050. That's 530-223-5050. Or stop by High Noble Safe Company at 2559 Larkspur Lane.
It's a bright new day. The sun is shining, the birds are singing, and there's never been a better day to try Mount Shasta spring water. Hi, I'm Bob the Drop. I come from a protected spring at the base of Mount Shasta. I'm bottled at the source. It doesn't get more cool and refreshing than that, and it's delivered right to your door. Yep, pure and simple, naturally the best. Start your bright new day by calling 1-800-922-6227 to order some of the best tasting water on the planet, Mount Shasta spring water.
Remodeled kitchen, bathroom, or backyard patio? There's a lot of choices, but only one leader, Estate Granite.
Mike Huber has such a professional attitude and a can-do work ethic that makes him a joy to work with. Mike and his crew worked to have our new kitchen finished in 5 days. We came back to a true work of art.
Hi, this is Brian Salato, broker and co-owner of The Real Estate Group. In today's competitive market, I think what's important is that the house is dialed in and turnkey. And what's important is that the kitchen has been renovated, the bathrooms have been renovated, granite, beautiful cabinetry. Those things make a significant difference.
Mike at Estate Granite has an eye for detail, an attention to perfection, and a quality build crew that are masters of their craft. Mike was there from start to finish.
Hi, this is Mike from Estate Granite. I know how important quality to a homeowner is, so give me a call at 241-STONE or come by our showroom at 4900 Mountain Lakes Boulevard or visit us at estategranite.com.
From the Pacific Justice Institute, this is The Legal Edge.
The Biden administration has stated that it would be sending, quote, strike force teams to private residences in order to question households on their vaccination status, as well as offer vaccinations. To be informed about your rights, visit pji.org.
We rely on your generous support to continue to provide justice for all. Learn more at pji.org.
Nothing says hang on to summer like classic root beer float treats. At Black Bear Diner, they paired sweet root beer and decadent vanilla cream in a dreamy cream pie filling to make a root beer float pie. Served in a graham cracker crust and topped with whipped cream and Marciano cherries. Grab one with your meal or box one up to go. Always shareable, always delicious. But hurry! Serve this month only at Black Bear Diner, 2605 Hilltop Drive, where you can always feed your inner bear. Dine in, delivery, and carry out available.
Black Bear Diner.
This is Carl Bott. Join Trish Clark and I on Thursday as we welcome Ready Rancheria to see the latest of what's happening out there with the Rancheria and Wind River. Also, cancel culture. Trish and I will be discussing just what is cancel culture and the impact it's had on so many people in our country. That's 7 to 9 a.m. Monday through Friday, Free Fire Radio, right here on KCNR, 96.5 FM at 1460 a.m., your talk radio.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
Remodeled kitchen, bathroom, or backyard patio? There's a lot of choices, but only one leader, Estate Granite.
Mike Huber has such a professional attitude and a can-do work ethic that makes him a joy to work with. Mike and his crew worked to have our new kitchen finished in 5 days. We came back
to a true work of art.
Hi, this is Brad Filato, broker and co-owner of The Real Estate Group. In today's competitive market, I think what's important is that the house is dialed in and turnkey. And what's important is that the kitchen has been renovated, the bathrooms have been renovated, granite, beautiful cabinetry. Those things make a significant difference.
Mike at Estate Granite has an eye for detail, an attention to perfection, and a quality build crew that are masters of their craft. Mike was there from start to finish.
Hi, this is Mike from Estate Granite. I know how important quality to a homeowner is, so give me a call at 241-STONE or come by our showroom at 4900 Mountain Lakes Boulevard or visit us at EstateGranite.com.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
You know, it can be difficult to find a trustworthy, knowledgeable, and yet affordable auto repair shop. Advanced Automotive is a second-generation, locally owned, full-service repair shop serving our community since 1993, and one of only four AAA-approved auto repair shops in the Reading area. Advanced Automotive has a goal, and it's to keep it simple to have safe, reliable vehicles for our customers and our community. Call or come by to meet the crew who is here to serve you. 244-4423 at Advanced Automotive.
Very often we write down a sentence too early, then another too late. What we have to do is to write it down at the proper time, otherwise it's lost. Thomas Bernard.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots, I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Happy NaNoWriMo!
Woo-woo!
We are the second day into November. I hope you've started your process to achieving your NaNoWriMo goals. To give you a little bit of motivation, we are doing a month-long giveaway.
You've heard us talk about the merchandise of Write Selfishly on a t-shirt and on mugs and that kind of thing.
Now on masks.
These will be what we're giving away at the end. We will do a drawing on our Facebook page.
So what you need to do to be entered into the giveaway is to like our Facebook page and then find one of us on NaNoWriMo website. We will include links to this on Facebook, on the landing page of this episode, and in the About Me section on our website.
And then every day that you hit your word goal, you'll be entered into this drawing for the end of the month.
Just send us a message on NaNo saying, hey, I'm entering your giveaway, and we will keep an eye on the goals that you enter into the NaNo website.
This is simply meant to be motivation to get you to be writing your book.
For me personally, NaNo means a lot. I did the Camp July NaNo, and that's what ended with me having a finished book. That's what ended with me having Toxic be able to release and publish. To help celebrate that, we are going to include copies of our books in this giveaway.
Our goal for this month is to give you kind of tricks of the trade, little things to keep in your arsenal when you're stuck. These little tricks will help you move your story forward. That is the purpose of this month. So the first thing we're talking about is writing right, right now. So, Lee, what is the biggest thing that holds you back from writing?
Perfectionism. When I hear the phrase writing right, right now, all I hear is writing right. I say I want it to be right the first time. I have to write it right the first time. And I don't track the right now part of it. Because when we say write it right, right now, we don't mean it has to be perfect right now. We mean just get it written right now.
When we are talking about your NaNoWriMo word count goals, we don't mean 1,667 perfect words. We mean 1,667 words that have been written. It's far more important to write it right now than to write it right.
Because there is no right way to write, especially on a first draft. Word vomit if you have to, just get it on the page. And that is the first trick of the trade. Just write something. You also want to avoid asking yourself certain questions while you are writing.
And I know this from experience. I built this list because I've asked myself these questions so many times, and every time it grinds my writing process to a halt.
Question number one, does this make sense?
You are not writing selfishly if you're asking yourself that question. You are thinking about your audience during your first draft. Does it make sense to you enough to when you can look back on it and polish it later?
Fix it in post.
Another question that I find grinds me to a halt is, what is the perfect word for this moment?
Throw in a filler word that you wouldn't use anywhere else in the story. Throw in brackets. Throw in an excessive amount of asterisks. Something that you remember that you can control F, find, and change later, so you aren't getting stuck on one word. Do not let one word derail your train.
Yeah, just keep moving and trust the editing process. If you have an idea of what happens next, write it. Don't let anything stand in your way.
Another question is a question of, is this redundant or is this just completely out of the blue? Is this continuitous? I don't know if that's a real word, but I'm using it.
It's a filler word that we'll fix and post. All you're doing at that point is just chewing through your writing time. Time is especially precious during this month because you have a lot to do in very little time. If you are rereading anything else, you are not moving forward. Just physics, you can't be doing both at once. So, best guess, I think I spelled her name with two N's and not one. We'll go with it and move on. The last question that I find myself stopping myself from writing is, have I spent enough time on this? Do I need to dwell in this moment a little bit longer? Or do I need to push forward, move past this, hurry up, instead of enjoying the moments as I write them? This is often, for me, a concern about word count, because I know my target word count for the book, and I want certain things to happen a third of the way in, two-thirds of the way in. When we're changing these acts, I need to get to this point by the time I hit 30,000 words.
This is one thing that I struggled with in July when I was writing Toxic. I got to the middle and realized I didn't have enough stuff in the middle. And I worried about that. I was like, do I need to add things? Do I need to add scenes? And then I don't remember what it was, but I finally realized if I need to add scenes, I will add it later. Let me just keep moving so I can get this written before midnight on July 31st.
For the record, if you know something is wrong, don't stop your thought process. Don't stop the pen. But if you know this is not the right word and I need to fix it later, I always circle it with my pen. That's what works for me.
I use Google Docs, so if I have a thing that I know I need to change, I'll just go and highlight it. So I found myself when I was writing Toxic, going through, hitting a spot where I realized, hey, this other thing needs to happen earlier for this scene to flow right. So I would do a quick search, find that scene that needs to change, highlight, comment saying, this needs to happen, and then went immediately back to where I was to continue writing. And it was just enough for me to say, okay, when I hit this in editing, then I can say, all right, let's add this, let's fix this. But it didn't distract me for more than 5 seconds.
All you're doing is putting a post-it down for yourself.
Exactly.
If you don't do this,
I would have forgotten a lot of what I needed to change.
So this concept of writing right, right now, looks different for you plotters versus you pantsers out there.
As a pantser, it feels like there's a lot more pressure because we work so much on inspiration. We work so much with needing the muse to strike for us to work. So we sit down, we think we know where we're going, you stare at that page, and your mind just goes blank. I know this, I've been there. And I'm really sorry for all you pantsers out there. I'm going to suggest probably the worst thing that all of us have to come to grips with eventually. You have to work sometimes without inspiration. You have to write down ideas as they come. Whenever that is, whether you're writing or not. And this may look a lot like an outline, but trust me, it helps. Also, stop mid-sentence. If you just start reading that sentence, it can do a lot to help you find your flow again.
Plotters, you aren't safe from this either. If you're like me, you are interested in the story because you feel like the story needs to be told. You know where you're going with it. You know what's going to happen when. And so the joy of discovering the story, of responding to the characters, can be a little lost. So make sure you don't over-outline, especially for NaNoWriMo, because then you lose enthusiasm. Last year, I switched projects mid-nano because I had one that I was really enthusiastic for, but I didn't know where I was going with it. I'm like, let's go find, see what happens. And now the other one is published.
So what are you waiting for? You're already on the second day of November. Get to work. Start writing. What is stopping you from writing that next scene?
Make sure your family knows, hey, from 4 to 8 in the morning, every morning, I'm going to be writing. Don't try to call me. Don't try to come in and ask for waffles. I will punt you out of the room if you try to interrupt me.
I am checked out for this time so I can reach my goal. If what's stopping you is you're not sure what's next, what is the next thing you know is going to happen? What needs to happen for that to occur? And what needs to happen for that to occur? Work your way backwards until you get to the point in your story where you're stuck. And then write. And if you have to, if you are sitting there staring at a blank page, skip whatever is holding you back, jump to the good parts, and get into it. Just get those words down.
I find that when I skip ahead, I'm skipping stuff that I would have edited out anyway. So I'm not wasting my time and wasting the reader's time, and then going, well, the reader needs to know this. Skip ahead, integrate it where you need to, move on. Leaving question marks in your character's backstory. In the world, blank edges of the map, things like this can be helpful in keeping your flow going. Because if you don't know, the reader probably doesn't need to know right away. So it's okay to have question marks. Be thinking about those not during your writing time, if you feel like they need to be fleshed out. But the most important thing is to always
write selfishly.
If you have a question or comment for our hosts or a topic you'd like us to cover, send us an email at writingroots@aspenhousepublishing.com or find us on Facebook by searching for Aspen House Publishing.
To write well, express yourself like the common people, but think like a wise man. Aristotle.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
And I'm finally back in studio, out of quarantine and COVID-free. We are continuing our series about the pearls from the masters by talking about Aristotle, one of the oldest storytellers that we know of.
Definitely one of the oldest sets of rules in storytelling that you can find. He mostly was talking about theater, about dramas that way, because, of course, most people couldn't read in that era. So most of the communication of any kind came in the form of theater and acting and stories in that capacity.
But the same principles apply today. So we're going to take a look at some of his quotes. Obviously, they've been translated from their original language, but we will be taking a look at the quotes and analyzing them using the same questions that we went over in the How to Learn episode at the end of December.
So I have to ask, do you agree with that opener of express yourself like a commoner, but think like a wise man?
Yes, because all writing needs to be understood. And who's going to be reading my writing? The common people. But I want to convey more than basic ideas in my writing.
I don't necessarily like the you have to be better than other people idea, because if you talk down to your audience, good things don't generally tend to follow that. But the separation between thoughts and words is an interesting translation to try to pull off successfully.
So one of the questions that we need to look at is whether or not we share a target audience with Aristotle. Basically, no. Entirely different culture and an entirely different time. But again, there's a little bit of truth, a little bit of knowledge that I can take even though we don't share the same target audience. So let's get into the rest of Aristotle's quotes that we have for you today. We're going to start off with one that is a good mindset when you are learning how to be a writer. It is the mark of an educated mind to be able to entertain a thought without accepting it. You need to be able to take advice and suggestions and entertain those ideas. Think about it, ponder it, and if it works, use it. If it doesn't, don't. But that's the only way you can get better is if you can entertain the thoughts that you may not necessarily agree with right off the start.
The next quote is, "The aim of art is to represent not the outward appearance of things, but their inward significance."
I feel like this is one of those where the target audience doesn't quite work for me. In my fantasy, yes. But in my mystery novels, I'm writing solely for entertainment. If you are writing with a goal to create art or literature, then yes, this absolutely applies. But if you're just writing to have some fun and entertain some people, I don't really feel like you really need to dig into the inward significance of things.
I would say this would apply to descriptions, not only location descriptions, but character descriptions. I don't care if your character has blonde hair unless it's part of her identity because all of her family for ages back had this platinum blonde hair and it's unique and she has attached inward significance to said blonde hair. But yes, I agree. Art isn't as much of a factor as why you're telling the information.
So on to the next quote. "Most important of all is the structure of the incidents. For tragedy is an imitation not of men, but of an action and of life. And life consists in action, and its end is a mode of action, not a quality."
Basically, what he's saying here is your character's background shouldn't just be to make him have a tragic background. It should be something that motivates his future, that changes his future. Yes, it's sad his dog died. What does that change beyond he's a sad character? How does that change his actions and his future?
I interpret this as something bad happening is not just because a person did it. there is a base for that action. There's something motivating it. There's something driving that. And all of life is action. It's choices. It's decisions. It's not just sitting there and going with the flow. That needs to be represented in writing somehow. Your characters need to act. They need to move. They need to do something.
It's definitely something that I wish I had learned sooner in my writing, but I'm not sure had I gotten this advice at that phase, I would have accepted it.
And it's Aristotle. It's hard to understand.
Yeah. A lot of this is a bit of a mess that we are attempting to unravel for you.
This next quote from Aristotle is, I think, one of the more important. It's not really a quote. It's the elements of drama that he has presented as fact.
These are spectacle, character, fable or plot, diction, melody, and thought. So that first one, spectacle, I associate with Sanderson's zeroth law of magic.
Err on the side of awesome.
Again, Aristotle was mostly talking theater here, but the drawing your attention, the jazz hands, the spectacle gets people to pay attention to the story.
People love fantasy because the spectacle is the world that it's set in. It's the characters, the magic, the creativity about it.
And that goes into the second one, which is character.
Character is so important in your writing. Without the characters, the viewers have nothing to connect with in the story.
The third one is fable/plot. He called it fable because most of the purpose of theater was to tell about the gods and their interactions with man and that kind of thing. But whatever your problem and solution is, that is summed up in this, your plot, the stuff that happens and what changes from the beginning to the end.
The next one is diction. This one's a little bit different because, again, we're talking about theater. But you can use this in your word choice. Instead of being how clearly it's said, it is the flow of the words within the story.
The next one is melody. I don't know that there's a whole lot we can take from that. We have spoken about the way your words fall on the page, and they can be rhythmic in order to help keep your reader entranced in what's going on. But we don't exactly have a soundtrack, so
we're going to slide right past that one and into thought.
A lot of that is about your subtext. If you're looking for a research tangent on that, we did an episode on subtext in November. Great episode, check it out. But your character's internal story and their external story are the thought and the plot of your story.
We will have a link on the landing page for this episode if you want to dig further into these elements of drama.
I agree with most of these. I feel like it's needlessly complex, but that's also kind of Aristotle.
Very true.
Obviously, spectacle, melody, these are things that are more toward filmmakers and toward theater geeks.
Playwrights and screenwriters.
But these are still things that you can apply to your writing. Still things that you can think about, and your style will bleed through when you've figured out the kind of spectacle of them walking away from an explosion. This next one I enjoy, and I think I might have it put into a plaque and put on the wall.
No great mind has ever existed without a touch of madness.
I think this is especially fun to apply to your mentor characters, because that little bit of Dumbledore saying he wants socks, that's what he wants most in his Mirror of Erised. That little bit of madness gives them a quirk that's a lot of fun to write.
I also think this gives a little bit of justification to the authors as they write when they think that they're just doing outlandish things. It goes along with Neil Gaiman's quotes that we used in his episode about how writing and storytelling is never trivial. No matter how wild it is, you can still have a great mind, and it's okay that there's a touch of madness and weirdness in there. Our next quote, to me, speaks to the process of writing. Excellence is never an accident. It is always the result of high intention, sincere effort, and intelligent execution. It represents the wise choice of many alternatives. Choice, not chance, determines your destiny.
I like this one because it feels like it's very easy to get stuck in the work element of whatever it is that you're writing. Great, now I have to go through and edit this chapter, blah, blah, blah. But that's where the excellence comes. Only after you edit the book a million times and you have 14 billion beta readers and this and that, does the excellence shine through. And it makes the work worth it in the end.
High intention, sincere effort, and intelligent execution. You need all of these to have an excellent product. Without that work, without the slogging through the editing, no matter how good your first draft was, it's never going to be good enough to publish. And it is your choice to do better, your choice to continue, your choice to improve it, that will decide how good that book does.
And that choice is most evident when you
write selfishly.
If you have a question or comment for our hosts or a topic you'd like us to cover, send us an email at writingroots@aspenhousepublishing.com or find us on Facebook by searching for Aspen House Publishing.
Go not to the elves for counsel, for they will say both no and yes. J.R.R. Tolkien.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hole.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Our monster of the day. These can really be true monsters. It's the Fae. Those tricky buggers.
We're talking not only fairies, but elves, pixies, sometimes gnomes are considered fae. There are a lot of creatures that are vaguely humanoid with a little bit of a magical twist and often have a very druidic nature in their style of magic. So we are calling them as a super category fae.
With the fae usually comes an almost human appearance. They have the same general shape. They're a humanoid. But there's something different. There's something magical, mystical about them.
A lot of times they're the people who wield the plant-type magic. So if you go into a fae kind of realm, they have their own homelands in a way. And they have interesting light. They are associated with interesting kinds of lighting styles and plant-based architecture. Bridges that are made out of vines and life in the trees and that kind of thing. Most of our monsters are going to be either animalistic or way above humans or a dumb version of humans. The Fae tend to be almost equivalent, if not for their longevity. And therefore they're able to be a little wiser in a lot of respects.
But the definition and the traditions of what fae are have changed and developed so much over the years. So in the 16th century, you had a philosopher, alchemist, toxicologist named Paracelsus who classified elves and gnomes as spirits of the air. And that's definitely not what we picture today when we think of elves and gnomes.
I think, like our opener quote kind of implied, Tolkien has redefined what elves are for us. Until Tolkien,
almost everybody thought of elves as being anywhere between child size to the size of your fist.
Tinkerbell size.
Yeah.
But now we picture elves as tall, elegant, graceful, walking beings because Tolkien redefined the word.
And I think a lot of the references that I hear to elves in my personal life end up coming through Dungeons and Dragons. They have a very Tolkien style of elf, although I do believe in the version I play, they're slightly shorter than humans.
It depends on the kind of elf. Going back to EverQuest, which was the first, like, digital version of D&D, this is where I got my definitions of elves. You had the high elves, which were very Tolkien-esque, tall, elegant elves. You had wood elves that were the shorter, more druidic-based elves. And then night elves, which are in D&D drow.
And if you wanted to listen to another episode talking about the character of elves, we did kind of mention this style in our Shoulder Angels episode, which was back in February, where we talked about the id, ego, super ego. A lot of this super ego stuff gets applied to elves. And that's why I am including Vulcans in the elf, mostly in just modern mythology.
They're space elves.
They play basically the same role in the story.
You go back in history, and elves are more like Santa's elves. Small creatures there to help, or Harry Potter's house elves, where they're helpers, they're servants in some kind of way. But elves aren't the only fae out there.
Probably my favorite are the Tinkerbell pixie type elves in the movie Willow. They were called brownies. The little guys that just kind of make mischief. They'll move stuff around and they'll maybe cast little bits of magic here and there and they can disappear and reappear. They apparently have a huge hankering for cream. They like get drunk off of fresh cream.
So you have your fairies, pixies, brownies. These are very Celtic in origin. There's a lot of those associations where you can throw out a handful of salt and they have to count every single bit of salt that fell.
That's how you catch a pixie, if you're curious.
Yeah.
And if you want more research on that, there's a fantastic Supernatural episode. It's great.
Fight the fairies! So you also have things like gnomes. Our definition of gnomes in the nerd world are different than the definition of gnomes in a lot of the normal world, because you have gnomes as in, like, World of Warcraft D&D gnomes, and then you have garden gnomes. They're very different.
But gnomes tend to be even smaller than normally a childlike house elf, and that's, I think, size is a big difference between gnomes and dwarves. But they enjoy the non-living parts of the earth, mostly gems and that kind of thing.
In a lot of, like, D&D type culture, they are associated with the tinkerers. They're the steampunk characters that are creating the mechanical what's-its that might just explode.
One of my fondest images of elves and the fae in general actually comes from Shakespeare. If you've ever seen A Midsummer Night's Dream, basically they get lost in the woods and this fairy queen comes and takes them on this adventure that they go on. And it's all very mystical and magical and everyone portrays it slightly different, which is one of my favorite things about Shakespeare. You'll never see the same Shakespeare twice.
You also have a lot of fae represented in Arthurian traditions. Prince Arthur and the fairy queen. If you've seen the recent Netflix show Cursed, it's a different representation of the fae and magical beings with King Arthur before he was King Arthur.
And I think Witcher had some references to elves in a way that is not commonly seen nowadays. They weren't the tall, elegant, must-be-respected kind of characters. So that was an interesting look at those characters.
Most of the ones we've been talking about are usually benign. Sometimes tricksters, sometimes out just to have a little bit of fun. But then you have some that are just straight up evil.
The red cap is basically an evil version of the gnome. They can be tamed, but mostly just by evil people, into becoming something between an ally and a pet.
One of the ones you may think of first would be the changelings. This was seen in the show and book series Outlander, the idea that these beings will switch out a infant child with a changeling child, and they'll kill the human child and force the humans to raise the changeling child so that they don't have to do it.
And in order to deal with the changeling, if it happens soon enough, they might be willing to, like, trade the child back if you manage to figure out that it's not your kid before they kill your actual kid.
You also have Will-o'-the-Wisps, and these are represented very differently in a lot of different media. So you have Brave, where the Will-o'-the-Wisps are treated more like light beings that are just leading her toward her destiny. But in a lot of classic traditions, if you followed the Will-o'-the-Wisp, you would die.
They often hung out around bogs and swamps. So if you followed this light, you would end up stuck in this bog and you would die there.
Historical basis for this. What actually was happening were gases from the swamp or bog lighting on fire, and it would just kind of flash and people would follow it and fall into the swamp. Like, that's what actually was happening. One of the biggest questions with the Fae is how do you deal with them?
We mentioned earlier throwing salt on the ground will stall them, so they have to stand there and count every single one.
A lot of the classic interpretations make Fae really vulnerable to iron, like it'll burn their skin if they touch it.
But mostly, I think the best way to deal with them is to just don't deal with them.
Avoid them and never make a deal with a fairy.
Absolutely. That's where a bit of the trickster magic comes in, which is very indicative of the fairies and the pixies.
So if you are interested in writing fairies, writing the fae into your story, remember that you aren't limited to what you've seen before. These traditions have changed and developed and become something completely new over the centuries. Pull from whatever part of it you want. That's what makes this fun.
I think fae will end up being a fantastic addition to a fantasy-type world. They're one of those monsters that are incredibly social. They have that whole culture to themselves, that they're doing their own thing. So it's easy to put a drop in. Your readers get an idea of, oh, the world is enormous, but they have enough of an idea to just sort of set that concept aside. But of course, writing elves are also a lot of fun. And that's what it comes down to, really, is having fun with it and
writing selfishly.
If you have a question or comment for our hosts or a topic you'd like us to cover, send us an email at writingroots@aspenhousepublishing.com or find us on Facebook by searching for Aspen House Publishing.
Tune in to North State Now Thursday nights at 6 p.m. on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. Our show features yours truly, Linda Bott, with Michelle Slade, Enjoy the Magazine, and Dr. Orna Gill, featuring music, art, health, wellness, shopping, and more.
The cost of a thing is the amount of what I will call life, which is required to be exchanged for it. immediately or in the long run. Henry David Thoreau.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Before we get into our question of the day, I want to remind you guys that we are on Patreon if you guys want to support us, help us out, let us keep creating these episodes. Go there for as little as $10 a month, which is basically a dollar an episode. You can help keep this podcast going.
Speaking of money, what is our question for today?
How do you set the price for a book?
I'm going to write a book saying how to make $1 million. And then I'm going to price my book at $1 million so that if I sell one, I'll have made $1 million.
Not a good plan. Mostly because the people with $1 million are not likely going to be looking to make $1 million.
Or maybe they'll buy two books so they can have $2 million.
Still not working.
So, obviously, we're just teasing here, but it is a legitimate question that a lot of especially first-time self-published authors will ask. How do I set the price for my book? I obviously don't want to set it so low that nobody thinks it's worth anything, but I don't want to set it for $1 million and leave it out of reach.
The price of a book varies by a lot of different factors. It's the kind of book that it is, whether it's physical or ebook, hardback or paperback, audiobook. All these have different ways of pricing your book, but it also depends on the trust that the reader has in the author and the value that the reader puts in that book, not the author. Because in this case, the customer's mindset matters the most. It doesn't matter how much you want to sell your book for. If the customer sees that as too much, they won't buy it. So in the exaggerated example of selling a book for $1 million titled How to Make $1 million, you're not hitting your target audience. One, I don't think anyone's going to pay $1 million for a book.
Maybe if it was like Da Vinci's manuscripts or something.
Yeah, some sort of ancient artifact that is priceless and never to actually be read. So it depends on your audience and what they want.
Under that category, I did want to mention that how your audience uses the book also comes into play. So if it's a coloring book, one person might buy the book more than once. If it's a comic book, it's meant to be read and then tossed over your shoulder so you can consume the next one as fast as possible.
I don't like your version of comic books. Comic books are made to be read and then carefully stored in case they become valuable later on.
Nerd. Another thing to consider as far as how you're using it is if it's a journal or a workbook, so some kind of devotional where you respond to the biblical passage or whatever. And then, of course, if it's educational, that'll also influence it because it's required for school, and so therefore they can charge an arm and a leg for it. So let's get into the pricing of how do you set a price for your book.
Let's start with probably the most expensive type of bookbinding book that you can sell in the fiction and for consumer nonfiction.
We're talking about hardbacks. Often this is the first version to be released, with a paperback coming a few months later, at least for the main author I've been reading lately. There's plenty of that. These tend to be 2 to 3 times the price of your paperback. The last one I purchased was around $30.
Mine was about $35. The thing with a hardback is if you go the traditional publishing route, if you are getting a book published in hardback, it means that you have established yourself as an author, as a trusted author, with a following of people willing to buy your book. Because hardbacks are expensive to produce. Traditional publishers will only invest in a hardback if they know that they're going to get the return on it.
Readers tend to purchase hardbacks for one of two reasons. If you're like me, you purchase it because you want to get it right away. You don't want to wait those extra couple of months for it to be cheaper. You want to be able to read it as fast as possible the moment you can read it. That means getting it in hardback, carrying it with you everywhere you go,
and consuming it as quickly and possible as you can.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.